What we're going to begin with, and for the vast bulk of the program, we're going to begin by taking a look at the historical development of the fascist milieu that we have been looking at for the past 2 weeks. We have been looking at a milieu consisting of elements of the petroleum industry, in particular the petroleum engineering industry and independent oil operators, the intelligence community, the defense industry, the political superstructure of America, and last but most assuredly not least, the Third Reich residua imported into the United States under the auspices of the intelligence organization of Reinhard Gehlen. Gehlen, whose last name once again is spelled G-E-H-L-E-N, was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front during World War II, and he and his entire organization, Fremde Heere Ost, or Foreign Armies East, generally abbreviated as FHO, were brought into the United States at the end of World War II. They became, in turn, the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs. They then became the de facto NATO intelligence organization. And finally, when the Federal Republic of Germany, the former West Germany, was incorporated in 1956, Gehlen and his organization were installed as the BND, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, the official intelligence service of first West Germany, now Germany. That organization has wielded an enormous impact on world history by virtue of its pivotal role in the Cold War, and the Gehlen organization and its effects are going to be one of the major foci of this long archive show that I'm doing. This is not to say that the Gehlen organization exists in a vacuum, far from it. On the contrary, the important thing about understanding the Gehlen organization is how it functioned, what permitted it to come into existence in the capacity that it came into existence, namely the multinational corporate milieu, which was very sympathetic to fascism, the large domestic fascist organizations in the United States, which, as we shall see, began to network with some of the elements brought in under the auspices of Gehlen and the very closely related anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. The Gehlen organization is a vitally important organization, and we're going to be taking a look in the weeks to come at the Gehlen organization as literally a Trojan horse brought into the United States. But I don't want any listener to make the mistake of thinking that the Gehlen organization exists in a vacuum. It is pivotally important, arguably the single most important political element in the second half of the 20th century, but it most assuredly does not exist in a vacuum, and it is vital to understand the political and economic environment, and also military environment, that it existed in order to understand how it came to have the influence that it had. What we're going to do this evening is go back all the way to the Second World War, and we are going to begin to take a look at, we are going to take a look at the historical development of the milieu that we looked at in the last 2 weeks, namely the intersection of the American far right, as I said, the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, the Gehlen organization, the defense industry, and some of the major American political movers and shakers over the last quarter of a century or so. The first thing that we're going to do this evening is listen to a radio show that was broadcast, an American radio program called High Command, that was broadcast during the closing year or two of the Second World War. This particular program might sound a trifle humorous to some people because it is, from a stylistic or formal standpoint, somewhat dated. It might sound a trifle hammy or corny, but the information communicated is not only very important, but beyond that I will be corroborating many of the central informational points from documentary sources as we proceed through the broadcast this evening. After listening to this program, which is approximately 45 minutes in length, we are then going to begin examining some information from a very important book, a book which very tragically was eclipsed along with the work of its author during the McCarthy period. That book, from 1944, is called The Nazis Go Underground by a very important anti-fascist writer named Kurt Ries, last name R-I-E-S-S. The first thing we're going to begin looking at is how the German General Staff in World War II was looking upon their broad plans for conquering certainly Europe and possibly the world. They were not just looking at the effects of one war, but rather they were thinking in terms of a decades-long strategy. That is important to understand because we're going to be looking in weeks to come at the Gehlen organization, which was a direct offshoot of the German General Staff and the German, the Third Reich National Security Establishment. We're going to be taking a look at how it wielded the influence it did in the United States. But first, we're going to begin taking a look at how the German General Staff planned to gain certainly European, if not world, domination. And it should be understood, and this is very important, that they did not intend to do it in one war. Rather, they were looking at a long-term strategy, something to be accomplished over a long period of time, and something that I would argue that they have accomplished as we prepare to move into the 21st century. Following that, we're going to take a look at the German General Staff's realization by October and by the last quarter, I should say, of 1941, that in fact the Second World War was lost from the Axis standpoint. The German General Staff actually had a meeting on December 9, 1941, 2 days after Pearl Harbor, at which they began to make plans for rebuilding the German army after what they saw as an inevitable defeat. Recall that, of course, on December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor was attacked by the Japanese. At that point, the United States was certain to enter the Second World War. The German General Staff understood the importance of that, as well as their inability to knock out the Soviet Union during the warm months, and the fact that the German General Staff had not planned to withstand the bitter Russian winter meant that they were going to get bogged down in a war of attrition on the Eastern Front. That is not something they had planned to do. The German General Staff, literally, on December 9, 1941, saw the handwriting on the wall, and they began to make plans to resurface after what they understood at that point was an inevitable German defeat. They then began to make plans to rebuild the German army after the war, and that'll be the next thing that we look at. After that, we're going to take a look at the German Nazi Party, the NSDAP's plans to go underground and then resurface. Although the German generals formally accepted that they were going to be defeated in December of 1941, the Nazi Party itself took a little longer. On May 16, 1943, the Nazi Party, in particular under the auspices of the SS and Gestapo, began making formal plans to not only go underground, but to resurface in years to come. It should be remembered that the last 2 years or so of World War II for the Third Reich represented what is known in military terms as a rear guard action. They were basically covering their retreat, and we're going to begin taking a look at how the Nazi Party planned to go underground, and in particular, how the going underground, the eclipsing, the willful self self-induced eclipse of the Nazi Party. Not the demise, but the eclipse of the Nazi Party was done under the auspices of Heinrich Himmler's SS and Gestapo. Himmler himself, as we shall see, was a student of underground political movements, and with 2 years to prepare for going underground, Himmler, with his expertise, was in a position to lay the groundwork for a resurgence of Nazism in years after the formal military defeat of the Third Reich. Following that, we're going to take a look at how, and this is a very important methodological consideration, and this particular methodological consideration is absolutely central to the long-term historical picture that we're going to be looking at, that we have been looking at in weeks past, and that we're going to be looking at for a number of weeks to come. One of the things, one of the lessons that the German military, as well as the Nazi Party leadership, learned from the German defeat at the end of World War I was that they could use communism or the threat of communism slash Bolshevism to their own political advantage. And again, it's very important to understand that neither the Third Reich nor the Reinhard-Gehlen organization that was an offshoot of it existed in a vacuum. Far from it. In fact, if we are to properly understand these things, it is to be understood that they did not exist in a vacuum, but rather they existed in a broad political and economic milieu which they were able to utilize to their own advantage. One of the things that I have talked about for many, many years here and that I go into every Memorial Day is the massive support provided by Western, in particular American, financial and industrial institutions to the fascist powers of Europe. Those industrialists who greatly feared the economic and political consequences of socialism slash communism Bolshevism were only too happy to collaborate with fascists, and it is that political reality that is central to an understanding of how the German General Staff and the Nazi Party were able to use the threat of communism or Bolshevism in a strategic manner. One of the things that we looked at in Radio Free America program number 10 was how the German army at the end of World War I was utilized to, or the supposedly demobilized German army at the end of World War I was utilized to combat the abortive socialist or Marxist revolution in Germany that took place on November 9th, 1918. The president of the Weimar Republic, the newly created Weimar Republic, Friedrich Ebert, set up three military organizations, the Freikorps or Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande, in which the supposedly demobilized German army was reconstituted to fight communism. This permitted the German general staff to not only retain power in Germany, because not only the industrialists and former imperial government officials, but also the social democrats themselves. The socialists were greatly afraid of the Bolsheviks and the workers and soldiers Soviets that were set up in the course of the abortive German Revolution, so they were only too happy to enlist the support of the German general staff and the supposedly demobilized German army. This permitted the German army to circumvent the regulations imposed, at least formally, by the Versailles Treaty. And as we have seen, the Freikorps or Freikorps, the Einwohnerwehren and the Zeitfreiwilligenverbande remained in place underground as the so-called Black Reichswehr. They not only continued to grow and to represent an underground formation and growth of the German army, but perhaps even more importantly, they systematically assassinated not only the Marxists, but the legitimate political, the legitimate democratic leadership of Weimar Germany, thereby paving the way for Hitler's rise to power. The next thing we are going to look at is how the threat of communism was used by the German general staff to retain the integrity of the German military and to promote its growth in spite of the Treaty of Versailles. And even more importantly, we are going to take a look at how the Allies at the end of World War I aided and abetted this situation, because they too were deeply afraid of the threat of Bolshevism. Recall that, of course, in 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution occurred, and this represented the first Marxist state in the world. Beyond that, it was an enormous empire, which now had a Marxist government. This was deeply terrifying to not only American industrialists and financiers, but the general staff, and indeed even to socialists themselves. And as a result of the fear on the part of the Western Allies that Germany, too, a major industrial power, might go, quote, communist, unquote, they aided and abetted the reinstitution not only of the former imperial government, but also of the German general staff and the military in general. No pun intended, they saw to it that the military remained in place, and they turned a blind eye to the rearming and reformation of the German military despite the Treaty of Versailles. And this strategic consideration, the awareness on the part of the German general staff, and later, as we will see, the Nazi Party, of how the fear of communism could be used to their own strategic and military advantage, that is central to the long-term understanding of the development of the forces that we are looking at in this massive archive show, as we are looking at the formation, the historical and political evolution of the milieu that we've been looking at the last 2 weeks, in which the American far-right, Third Reich residua, the petroleum industry, the U.S. intelligence community, the defense industry, and the mainstream American political structure are synthesized. The awareness on the part of the Germans of this tactical consideration is absolutely central to the formation and development of this milieu, and that milieu is in control not only of the United States, but the world at this time. Following that, we're going to take a look at, once again, sticking with Kurt Reese's The Nazis Go Underground, we're going to take a look at how the Germans viewed, at the end, this says World War II drew to a close, at how they viewed the coming occupation of Germany. As one might well expect, they feared most of all a partial or complete occupation of Germany by the Red Army, because that would have been inimical to the reformation not only of the industrial structure of Nazi Germany, which, recall, as we've looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, was deeply involved, as well as the first two Radio Free America shows, was deeply involved with and cooperated with actively the multinational corporate community, American industrialists and financiers in particular. By the way, we're covering a very wide, we're covering a large piece of history this evening. There is no way, even during the course of this long archive show that I'm going to be doing in installments, that I can fill listeners, particularly new listeners, in on all of the aspects of what I'm looking at. So I strongly recommend that listeners who are new or who do not have the information, such as Uncle Sam and the Swastika, U.S. Industrial Cooperation with the Third Reich, the first two Radio Free America shows, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, please get a hold of those, because those are absolutely central to an understanding of the historical forces that we're examining during the course of Radio Free America 37. But again, the Third Reich, as its at least formal demise was approaching, understood that having the Western Allies, the United States and Germany and France, occupy Germany was vital to their survival and to the perpetuation of the political realities of the Third Reich, and that the partial or complete occupation of Germany by the Soviet Union would be inimical, would be absolutely devastating to their long-term prospects for revival. Following that, we're going to take a look at a book called The Last Hero, Wild Bill Donovan by Anthony K. Brown. We're going to take a look at a very interesting, important, and enigmatic chapter in World War II history. Namely, we're going to take a look at not only the negotiations which were being undertaken by the German General Staff under Vatican auspices with the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, that was America's World War II intelligence service, the precursor of the CIA. We are going to take a look at those negotiations, those attempts by the German General Staff to open up the Western Front to Eisenhower's armies, thereby permitting the Allies, the Western Allies, I should say, to occupy most of Germany. By the way, bear in mind, too, that as any competent history of the Third Reich will demonstrate, I'm not going to go into that in any detail this evening, one of the things that Hitler sought to do during the closing months in the last year or two of the Second World War was to convince the United States and Britain to abandon their alliance with the Soviet Union and to hook up with Germany and to engage in an anti-communist crusade. Any competent history of the Third Reich, William L. Shirer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, any good history of Nazi Germany will discuss that, any good history of the Second World War. I'm not going to go into that at any great length, but bear in mind that that was a major strategic goal of the Third Reich during the closing years of the war. Again, we're going to be taking a look at, from the last hero, how the German General Staff was formally making approaches to the United States and Britain under the auspices of the Vatican, and by contacting the officers of strategic services, they were seeking to open up the Western Front to Eisenhower's armies. Now, the official history has it that no such deal was ever cut. However, as Anthony K. Brown points out, the curious episode of the Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen. The Ludendorff Bridge was one of the largest bridges over the Rhine River, one of the major defense points of the Third Reich during the closing months of the war. That bridge, curiously, was never blown, and this permitted Eisenhower's armies to not only capture the bridge intact, but to pour into Germany. And that particular capture, the capture of the Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, the bridge over the Rhine, did in fact permit the Western Allies to occupy most of Germany, despite the fact that the Red Army had handled the bulk of the fighting in Europe, even after D-Day, but certainly virtually all of it up to the invasion of Normandy in June of 1944. And as Anthony K. Brown points out, it may have been, this is by no means definite, but it may have been that the Ludendorff Bridge was deliberately kept intact. As he says, anyone familiar with clandestine operations can view this curious historical episode and its official explanation with a cold eye. This is not something which is definite, but certainly Stalin was operating under the assumption that there had in fact been a deal between Nazi Germany and the Western Allies to permit the Western Allies to occupy most of Germany. There certainly were negotiations underway. Officially, they did not come to any serious fruition, but as Anthony K. Brown points out, the episode of the Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen suggests that official history to the contrary notwithstanding, such a deal may have been cut. And again, this is not something that I am saying with any degree of, I'm not saying this definitely, but as Anthony K. Brown documents, it is certainly a possibility that has to be very seriously considered. Food for thought and grounds for further research. although I personally doubt that we will ever know the full truth. Following that, we're going to take a look at an interesting piece of information in the author's notes, Anthony K. Brown's preface to The Last Hero. And for those people who think that perhaps all of this stuff about World War II is a little too arcane, it happened too long ago, so what, who cares, it has no current relevance, we're going to take a look at what happened to the first four people who attempted to write the history of the Office of Strategic Services in the post-World War II period, the first four major historians who attempted to set the historical record straight and to shed the light of history on the secret operations of the OSS died before they were able to do it. Finally, Anthony K. Brown was approached by none other than William Casey, who became CIA director under Ronald Reagan. Casey was in charge of secret intelligence in Europe for the OSS during World War II, and William Casey tabbed Anthony K. Brown to do the official history because, as he said, and this was in 1977, Britain would be a Anthony K. Brown is from Britain, said a British citizen would be a perfect person to do the history because he would be neither Democrat nor Republican. This simply by way of underscoring even more than 30 years after the formal end of World War II, the importance and the political sensitivity of the information from the period that I'm going into at this time. One of the major methodological considerations for the reconstitution of the Third Reich as it saw its defeat approaching was to form alliances with the very powerful fascist movements in other countries. Again, in numerous archive shows, I have discussed the profound role of American industrialists and financiers, as well as other Western industrialists and financiers, in helping to not only arm Nazi Germany, but to support Hitler politically. It should be remembered that, as we looked at in Radio Free America 10, among other programs, as well as the first two Radio Free America archive shows, these same industrialists and financiers helped to back very, very strong fascist movements in the United States, as well as other Western countries. Other industrialists and financiers in France and Britain did the same thing. Many of these organizations were viewed as, quote, nationalist, unquote, but in fact, they were fascist. One of the things that Kurt Rees talks about is how the plans, and again, this book was written in 1944, the plans for the reconstitution of the Third Reich would have undoubtedly involved the hooking up of underground Third Reich elements with many of the fascist elements which were still active to a considerable extent in some of the Western nations, the Western Allied nations. We're going to take a look in particular at a recommendation or a... what Kurt Rees does here is he speculates that if he were preparing a coming Nazi underground, he would certainly follow what appears to be the methodology of the Third Reich, and that is form alliances with some of the fascist elements in the United States and Britain. And interestingly enough, the very first individual, a wealthy tycoon and an individual very active on behalf of, quote, nationalist, translate, fascist organizations, was a fellow named William Grace. And interestingly enough, a very, very good friend and longtime associate of William Grace was none other than Count Sergei de Morenshield, George de Morenshield, one of the Third Reich emigre who we looked at in connection with President Kennedy's assassination. And it should be remembered that George de Morenshield was a buddy of George Bush's and apparently worked in conjunction with Bush, certainly in relation to their mutual interest and operations in the petroleum industry, and quite possibly in connection with their work for the U.S. intelligence system as well. De Morenshield hooked up with William Grace, and a hookup with William Grace was one of the things that in 1944 Kurt Rees had envisioned as a way of helping to bring fascism to America, or as a way, I should say, well, of bringing fascism to America, but as a way that the Third Reich might seek to perpetuate its influence. Interestingly enough, another organization that Kurt Rees sees as a likely target for Third Reich infiltration after World War II in order to rebuild fascism and Nazi Germany eventually was the American Vigilant Intelligence Federation of Harry A. Jung. That organization collaborated actively with the Hitler-Goebbels anti-Comintern that we looked at last week. That organization also provided the seed for the The American Security Council, a key element of the World Anti-Communist League, and an organization which was instrumental, was central, to the milieu that we've been looking at, and instrumental in helping to promote the agenda of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. We will be taking a look at the Kennedy Conspiracy by Paris Flamand for documentation on the relationship between William Grace and George de Morenchild. By the way, Grace's son, J. Peter Grace, a key member of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, or Knights of Malta, that we looked at in Radio Free America programs 17 and 21, became a key functionary in Ronald Reagan's administration. He was, as far as I know, never a formal cabinet member, but he was part of the President's Council on Cutting Costs in Government. Also an individual who was very close to Otto Ambrose. Otto Ambrose was an I.G. Farben engineer and an individual who set up the slave labor camps at Auschwitz during World War II and also developed the poison gas used to dispatch the victims of the Third Reich in those camps under the auspices of Hitler's Final Solution. We will review briefly the relationship, the seminal relationship between Harry Jung's American Vigilant Intelligence Federation and the American Security Council, an organization that we looked at last week. By way of a transition to the next installment of Radio Free America 37, we are then going to take a look at a short section of the book Blowback by Christopher Simpson, and we're going to take a look at the relationship between the Office of Strategic Services Special Intelligence Branch and the Reinhard Galen Organization, and we will see in this hookup between the OSS's Special Intelligence Branch and Galen the development, the political genesis, and the national security genesis of a number of key people who have not only influenced the CIA, but also the American government and world affairs in the years since, people like Alan Dulles, the aforementioned William Casey, Frank Wisner, Richard Helms. All of these people were deeply involved with the OSS's Special Intelligence Branch, that, in turn, deeply involved with the organization of Reinhard Galen. And the Galen Organization is one of the central elements in this long and developing archive show. We will be looking at that next week. So that, in a nutshell, a coconut shell under the circumstances, is what we have on tap for this evening. I'm going to take a musical break, and then we're going to come back with the first installment of tonight's installment of Radio Free America program number 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War.